Star Tide Rising, Cassette 3.
The dry sections of the starship Streaker were extensive, though they served only 8 members of the crew. The 130 dolphins, down by 32 since they had left Earth, could only visit the dry wheel by riding a mechanical walker or spider. There were some rooms that should not be flooded with hyper-oxygenated water, nor be left to the gravity fluctuations of the central shaft when the ship was in space. There were stores that had to be kept free of moisture, and machine shops that performed hot processing under gravity. And there were the living quarters for humans and chimp. Denny stopped at an intersection. She looked down the hallway and thought about knocking on the door 2 cabins down. If Tom Worley were in, this could be the time to ask his advice about a problem that was daily growing more irksome. How to handle Sout's unusual attentions. There were few people better qualified to advise her on non-human behavior. Worley's official title was Alien Technologies Consultant, but clearly he was also here as a psychologist to help Dr. Metz and Dr. Baskin evaluate the performance of an integrated dolphin crew. He knew cetaceans and might be able to tell her what Sout wanted from her. Denny's habitual indecision reasserted itself. There were plenty of reasons not to bother Tom right now, like the fact that he was spending every waking moment trying to find a way to save all of their lives. The same could be said of most of the crew, but experience and reputation suggested that Orly just might come up with a way. Denny sighed. Another reason to put it off was pure embarrassment. It wasn't easy for a young femme to ask personal advice of a Mel as worldly as Orly, particularly when the subject was how to cope with advances by an amorous porpoise. However kind Tom's intentions, he would be forced to laugh, or, obviously, bite back laughter. The situation, Denny admitted, would have to seem funny to anyone but the object of the seduction. Denny quickened her pace up the gently curved corridor toward the lift. Why did I ever go into space anyway? Sure, it was a chance to advance my career, and my personal life was a shambles on Earth. But now where am I? My analysis of Cthulhuan biology is getting nowhere. There are thousands of bug-eyed monsters circling over the planet, slathering to come down and get me, and the horny dolphins harassing me with suggestions that would make Catherine the Great blush. It wasn't fair, of course, but when had life ever been fair? Streaker had been built from a modified Snark Hunter class exploration vessel. Few snarks were still in service. As Terrans became more comfortable with the refined technologies of the library, they learned to combine the old and new, ancient galactic designs and indigenous Terran technologies. This process had been in a particularly awkward phase when the Snarks were built. The ship was a bulb-ended cylinder with jutting crane-like reality flanges in 5 bands of 5 along her hull. In space, the flanges anchored her to a protecting sphere of stasis. Now they served as landing legs as the wounded Streaker lay on her side in a muddy canyon, 80 meters below the surface of an alien sea. Between the 3rd and 4th rings of flanges, the hull bulged outward slightly for the dry wheel. In free space, the wheel rotated, providing a primitive form of artificial gravity. Humans and their clients had by now learned how to generate gravity fields, but almost every Earth ship still possessed a centrifugal wheel. Some saw it as a trademark, advertising what some friendly species had recommended Terrans keep quiet, that the 3 races of Sol were different from any others in space, the orphans of Earth. Streaker's wheel held room for up to 40 humans, but right now there were only 7 and 1 chimpanzee. It also held recreation facilities for the dolphin crew, pools for leaping and splashing, and sexual play during off-duty hours. But on a planet's surface, the wheel could not turn. Most of its rooms were tilted and inaccessible, and the great central bay of the ship was filled with water. Denny rode a lift up one of the spokes connecting the dry wheel to the ship's rigid spine. The spine supported Streaker's open interior. Denny stepped from the elevator into a hexagonal hallway with doors and access panels at all angles until she reached the main bay lock 50 meters forward of the wheel spokes. In weightlessness, she would have glided rather than walked down the long passage. Gravity made the corridor seem eerily unfamiliar. In the bay lock, a wall of transparent cabinets held spacesuits and diving gear. Denny chose a bikini from her locker and a face mask and flippers. Under normal circumstances, she would have donned coveralls, a small jet belt, and possibly a pair of broad arm wings. She could have leapt into the central bay and flown the humid air to any place she wanted, providing she was careful of the rotating spokes of the dry wheel. Now, of course, the spokes were still, and the central bay contained something more humid than air. She quickly stripped and stepped into the swimsuit. Then she stopped in front of a mirror and tugged at the strings until the bikini was comfortable. Denny knew she was attractively built. At least the Mels she knew had told her so. Still, slightly broad shoulders gave her an excuse for the self-reproach she always seemed to be looking for. She tested the mirror with a smile. The image was instantly transformed. Strong white teeth brilliantly balanced her dark brown eyes. She let it lapse. Dimples made her look younger, an effect to be avoided at all cost. She sighed and carefully pushed her jet black hair into a rubber diving cap. Well, let's get this over with. She checked the seals on her note case and entered the lock. When she closed the inner hatch, fizzing saline water began flooding into the chamber from vents around the floor. Denny avoided looking down. She fumbled with her Bateau breather mask, making it snug over her face. The transparent membrane felt tough, but it passed air in and out freely as she took rapid, deep breaths. Numerous flexible plates around its rim would help pull enough air from supercharged oxywater. At the corners of her vision, the mask was equipped with small sonar displays, which were supposed to help make up for a human's substantial deafness underwater. Warm, bubbling wetness climbed her legs. Denny readjusted her face mask several times. Her elbow pressed the note case close against her side. When the liquid had almost reached her shoulders, she immersed her head and breathed hard with her eyes closed. The mask worked. Of course it always did. It felt like inhaling a thick ocean mist, but there was enough air. A bit sheepish over her fearful little ritual, she stood up straight and waited for the water to rise over her head. At last the door opened, and Denny swam out into a large chamber where spiders, walkers, and other dolphin gear lay neatly folded in recesses. Tucked into orderly shelves were racks of the small water jetpacks that the dolphins used to move about in the ship in weightlessness. The jets made amazing acrobatics possible in freefall, but on a planet with most of the ship flooded, they were useless. Usually one or two Fen were in this outer dressing room, wriggling into or out of equipment. Puzzled by the emptiness, Denny swam to the opening at the far end of the chamber and looked into the central bay. The great cylinder was only 20 meters across. The vista wasn't as impressive as the view from the hub of one of the space cities of Sol's asteroid belts. Still, whenever she entered the central bay, her first impression was one of vast and busy space. Long radial shafts stretched out from spine to cylinder wall, holding the ship rigid and carrying power to the stasis flanges. Between these columns were dolphin work areas, arrayed on supports of resilient mesh. Dolphins, even the Tursiops amicus, didn't like being cooped up any more than they had to be.